virtue of how things are going with the chorus, what I'm going to do today is just cover several things so I can get you up to speed for Friday, where you're going to try, after having started on past Friday with just the very first options of evolving a simple PDE system, I'm going to just try and cover as much as possible because we want to reach some particular goal on Friday. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about stability. So remember, we discussed some of the conditions of stability. We talked about why we introduce kind of a parameter here, or H, that connected the time stepping in time with the grid spacing in the spatial direction. And this was a control parameter we could take to ensure we're within the domain of stability of a particular algorithm that we choose to iterate in time. So I'll say a few more words about that today. Then we're going to move into boundaries. We saw the very beginnings of boundaries last week, but now we want to go deeper in it and then set the right stage for analyzing general problems, but also want to say something about errors. How do you know that once you get a solution, that is a solution to the problem you were trying to code to begin with? So I'm going to state some results. These are results you can find in literature. I'll give you some references later. I'll just load them in the wiki. But this is a very basic result that essentially is a theorem that says stability will only be possible only achievable if, and let me just write it first and then explain, is if the numerical domain of dependence contains the analytical domain of dependence. If you recall, if you were able to do those that particular part of the exercise on Friday where you were trying different algorithms, different discretizations, and we had three options, one where you did the center, the other one you slanted to the right, and the other one that you slanted to the left, it was one of those that gave you something that was unstable, and many of you saw that very clearly. So if we had that equation u, t equal u, x, and you chose to approximate the time derivative this way, these two points between level m plus 1 and level n, and you chose to use these two points to take the derivative, the spatial derivative, that one was unstable. And that's unstable basically because it's violating this condition. There's no way we can change this algorithm, make lambda as small as possible, where this algorithm will work. And the reason is, if we analyze analytically this equation, we know that the general solution of this very simple equation is any function, as we said in, last week, that propagates from right to left. So analytically, the domain of dependence of that point is slanted this way, where this, well, actually it's this way. It's just a characteristic along this direction, right? So, and how much, what is the slope is given by the factor here. I chose a factor to be 1. So it's a line at 45 degrees. So the value of the function here is uniquely determined by the value of the function there. But if my numerical domain of dependence happens to be this, the most I can know is what's going on in here. And I'm not containing the analytical domain of dependence. So I'm not containing the part of the information that will determine the solution there. And as a result, this is going to be invariably unstable. That doesn't mean that if you satisfy it, it will be stable. That's not, this is it's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. So this is one of the conditions you have to satisfy. But just to kind of motivate and show why we chose the lambda, suppose you have a scheme, and let's imagine we're thinking about this equation, which I'm quickly going to move into. So we know analytically, if I'm thinking of that point, the analytical domain of dependencies, these two lines at 45 degrees, and then all this data here determines the solution at that point. Now, let's say for the sake of the argument that your scheme is a scheme that has these 3 points involved. And we try to get the solution there. Now, the numerical domain of dependence is this one. So now the numerical domain of dependence is not containing the analytical domain of dependence. We're violating that. But this is very easily done if I now change this lambda 1. Let's say there's one value of lambda. But if I have used this other value of lambda, right? Now I'm trying to determine that point. The analytical domain of dependence is this one, right? Lines at 45 degrees going to the past. But still, my numerical domain of dependence is that one, because I'm still using these 3. So now I have a chance of getting something that's stable. So that's something you have to be bear in mind. And this kind of underlines and stresses the fact that you need to know as much as possible from the analytical consideration of your problem before you actually go into numerics. The worst thing you can do is just follow what some people would say, oh, if in doubt, just throw it in the computer and the computer will tell you. Usually what that's going to tell you is that everything breaks down. So don't do that. So just try and make sure you exercise as much as you can knowledge of your equation. So I'm going to go to this equation now because I want to kind of show a much more complex case that we're going to use to base our discussions on how to treat boundary conditions. So first,
please.
Yes.
So with respect to what you just said, how do we in practice determine the domain of dependence?
Good. So I can tell you that right now.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wasn't going to go there, but this will let us see this. So in practice, let me just first imagine that. Remember, we discussed. Suppose we put our problem in this shape. Let's imagine we're in one dimension. Right? Then we said we're going to hope, and then most physical problems that we deal with are such as satisfy this condition because we think the problem should be well posed, that this matrix diagonalizes. Right? That means there is a, in reality, this problem can be written in terms of something that now looks like this. Plus the rest. Why is it, let me just kind of stress again, why is that this is particularly convenient? It's because there are a theorem that tells us that if this is diagonalizable, at least locally, all the behavior of perturbation is determined by this. This rest picks a particular solutions, but as far as how things are moving, this is enough. So just by looking at this is called the principal part of the equation, then I can ask many of these questions, and this will tell me. So now you're asking, how do we determine the domain of dependence? But it says we just look at this eigenvalue. So we take, if we think of the solution to that point, if we're perturbing with respect to a background solution, then this matrix will depend on that background solution. But we ask, what is the largest positive eigenvalue and what is the largest negative eigenvalue? This will bound the domain. So the largest positive eigenvalue will give me that slope. So it will tell me, OK, I have to go all the way there to get the information, at least for one of those variables, determine the solution here. And then on this side would be that one, for instance. I could have a situation where all of these are zero. So in reality, my domain of dependence is just a point. It's just going up the straight line. So that's a way to get it very clear. But we're going to keep using this more and more and very explicitly to understand how to give boundary conditions. Because we're going to go back to say, OK, what are the values of these eigenvalues? And something is positive is coming from right to left. Something negative is coming from left to right. And we're explicitly going to use it. This is why I want to look at this equation, because it's richer than just considering advection equations. So the first thing we do, and again, I'm going to stress, this can be done already at the second order, but it's much cleaner if we reduce to first order, is to write this in the following way. Right? Remember, we discussed this example. So if I introduce the variable f, which is the gradient, the spatial gradient of phi, and the variable g, which is the time derivative of phi, then this problem becomes that problem. So we traded a second order equation for a single variable for three equations that are first order. So it looks like we're going to work harder, but there are lots of things that will become cleaner once we look at, we analyze the problem this way. Let me just go to the other block. So we can say, well, now let's discretize this problem. How do we understand how to do, say, boundaries? So in principle, if there are no boundaries, we can just go ahead. This system is perfectly nice, but we're going to see kind of the benefits of having written this way when we have to deal with boundaries. So what we can do is just think of the following equation, or the following way of writing this. So the first thing I notice at this I comma t, if I understand, if I know g, then I can trivially iterate phi. So I can put this aside for the time being. I can put in the matrix, but it will be simpler if I just leave this for a second and then I'll bring it back. So I have the equations g comma t. Let me write this way, gf. This is standing for our vector u. So it's a vector u that has the two unknowns, g and f. The equations are this one comma t, 0, 1, 1, 0. The only thing I did is I've just rewrote the system of equations. But the reason I want that is because now I'm going to ask the questions that we said formally we were asking here. So is this matrix diagonalizable? Well, first, yeah. Let's just go even a step back. So are the eigenvalues real? So we just go do standard linear algebra and we find out that lambda is equal to plus minus 1. And of course, this we knew from physical grounds, this following Giffre's question. We know that we're dealing with the second order wave equation that has things that propagate at speed 1 and minus 1. So this is just making that manifest here. So is it diagonalizable? And the answer is yes. We know this trivially because we have a 2x2 matrix and the eigenvalues are different than real. Therefore, if they are different, we know it's diagonalizable. That's a no linear algebra result. But if not, we can just work it out and we find out that, yeah, there is an eigenvalue lambda plus, say for a lambda, for the eigenvalue lambda equal 1, the eigenvector, the plus, I'm gonna call it, is the 1, 1. And I can normalize it, but I don't care at this moment for it to be normalized. And for lambda, the R1, lambda equal minus 1, then E minus is 1 minus 1. So this tells me what combination of those variables propagate with speed 1, and which one propagates with speed minus 1. Of course, for this very simple example, we didn't have to work hard. We just see that trivially, because I see that if I add these two equations, then I have g plus f comma t is equal to g plus f comma x. And if I subtract the two, I have g minus f comma t is equal to minus g minus f comma x. Right, so this we could have just done without having to work and diagonalize the matrix or anything. We would recognize that, oh, the addition of g plus f is something that propagates to the right, or to the left, at least perturbations, and the subtraction of g and f propagates to the right. So now we want to use that to find a recipe or a clean way of dealing with boundaries. And at first sight, it's gonna look counterintuitive, but after you think about it a few times, you'll see that it's the natural thing to do. So suppose now we're gonna go begin thinking of the discrete case. Let's say our domain is this one. We're gonna discuss the right boundary. The left boundary will be very similar, except we're gonna trade the variable that we care about. So we know that for all intent purposes, F plus G moves from right to left. F minus G moves from left to right. So whatever we do, we sure as hell don't want to be putting a boundary condition of F minus G, because that one is going to the boundary. The solution here is being determined by what's going on in the interior. The free data is what we can give for F plus G. But of course, in this very simple example, we could just change variables and go to a new system of equations that is in terms of the variable G plus F and the variable G minus F. But in general, that might be too cumbersome. We just have a clean set of variables, and now we want to know what the boundary condition we want to impose implies on G and F. So let me tell you what we're going to do. So first, we can say, well, the combination F minus G, we don't want to do anything. The combination of F plus G, that we have a right to give a boundary condition. Right, so this one we shouldn't touch. This is the one we're allowed to give boundary condition. So let's imagine that our boundary condition is such that nothing is coming from the right side. So F plus G will be equal to zero. We want to maintain F plus G all through. So an F minus G has to be whatever it has to be. So I'm going to do something very silly, but F minus G has to be equal to F minus G. On this one, we want to impose a zero at the boundary. So from here, we can just say, well, so let me call this momentarily V minus, because it's, or, yeah, because it's the one that propagates from left to right. And this one, let me call it V plus. Then we're going to say, oh, at V plus, we can give whatever value we want. At V minus, we cannot do anything. It has to be whatever it wants to be. But from here, I can say, well, if I add these two equations, then you have F is B minus plus V plus divided by 2. And G is minus V minus plus V plus divided by 2. So the right, I haven't done anything particular. This is just the identity. We're just renaming things and then realizing this is what the relationship between F and G are with B minus and B plus. But now is where we say, well, let's just put the boundary condition, and the boundary condition we want to put is a V plus is zero. And so our condition would be something where F, we want to impose that F happens to be equal to V minus divided by 2, and G is equal to V minus divided by 2. At the right boundaries. So I'll tell you in a second what is it that we're going to do, but let's just pause for a second because it's very weird. We arrived at something that a priori might look like we're over-specifying the problem. We have a second-order equation. We know that at most we can give two boundary conditions, one on the left and one on the right. And what I'm telling you is that we're going to try to find a way to force this to happen. So it looks as though we're imposing two boundary conditions, one for F and one for G, right? This is what I'm going to say. This is what I'm going to want to impose for F, and this is what I want to impose for G. But in reality, it came from a single boundary condition. We said something, we set V plus to zero, and we're not touching V minus. V minus will be whatever it has to be. So in practice, the way you go about doing this is you're doing, say, your boundary points. You're trying to iterate up to this, all these points interior with those equations, F, T equal G, X, and G, T equal F, X. Now we get to this last point. Because this point is interior, and let's say we're using a center derivative scheme of second order, and so I can evaluate this right-hand side and define what the value of the point is there. But I cannot do it there. So the recipe says, or the recipe will say, just take this difference, compute the right-hand sides, slanting your derivatives, right? So if we have at this point, we describe a particular derivative operator satisfying summation by parts, where we took the derivative here to be computed by those two points. Immediately, that should raise a flag, because you're saying, well, we're slanting things to the left when there is true piece of information that should be coming from the right. But we're not going to do that. We're not going to iterate yet those equations. We're going to compute the derivatives this way. Then from here, that would be step one. This would be the standard one. Step two would be compute f plus g, comma t, and compute f minus g, comma t. I add and subtract these two and save the value. This would be b plus, comma t, and this will be b minus, comma t. Now, this one we're going to, so far we have done nothing. So this has been an identity so far. So now it's a third step. And you said set b plus, comma t equal to 0. Let's say if our boundary condition was b plus is 0, then that means that b plus, comma t is 0. Right? It's the same equation. So now you set that one and use these expressions to say f, comma t. So I take the time derivative, say, of this equation, it would be the same. To be b minus, comma t divided by 2, and g, comma t equal minus b minus, comma t divided by 2. So when we, once we do that, we're actually, notice that now we are only allowing the combination of f minus g to be part of our algorithm. And that's the one that is moving that way, and that we didn't touch. The only one we force something on is in this one. And as a result, this combination gives you what you wanted. Is that clear? No? Okay, just ask the question, at what point it did not become clear, and then try say it again.
Sorry, I'm just confused about why you don't go from what's on the board on top straight to step three.
Straight step three?
Yeah.
That's fine. But remember, at some point, I need to involve the true value, the value of the amount of information that I can rely on. The information you can rely on is the piece of your solution that is propagating towards the boundary from the interior. That you want to respect and to keep track of. That's why I go from one to two. The one is just equation. I haven't done anything. Two is just, I just look for the combination that tells me this is moving one way or this is moving the other way. Now, things are coming from the outside in. I know I can do whatever I want with them. That's my boundary condition. But the other one, I have to save it, because I'm saving pristine. I put it to the side, and then I have to bring it back. Right? And that's that piece here. So if I keep this one, I still somehow need to have kept track of what f minus g was doing, right? That combination, the combination that was moving from inside to the boundary. There is more than one way of doing this. This is the way I find it the cleanest. But as long as you keep track of this f minus g and use it back in this, then you're going to be fine. So let me just give you another example. That was the example where we push f plus g to be 0. So that would have been an equation. So if you actually put this, and this is hopefully what I will tell you on Friday to work on. So we would have put, say, a pulse in the middle. The pulse would have begin to move. Perhaps a piece will go to the left, a piece will go to the right. As it goes to the right, this one just goes, because the one that moves from left to right, we're respecting, we're letting it go as it should, and we didn't allow anything to come in. But let's imagine that the boundary condition we want now is a reflecting mirror here. So now we want f plus g to exactly equal f minus g so as to be able to reflect back. So now our condition now changes. I want v plus to be equal to v minus. That's probably connected. Oh.
Sorry, Luis, I think that was the key confusion I had.
Yeah.
So you're saying so far, in the previous example, not now, we were letting signal disappear.
Yeah.
We will stop looking.
We would stop looking. Now, if I watch the solution, you'll see this pulse that is going towards the boundary, and then just goes, and then you don't see it again.
Oh, I see.
Right, because we're setting the piece that is coming from the inside towards the boundary to go as it should, because that's mathematically what we have to do.
The boundary is absorbing the signal, or just letting it go away?
The boundary is transparent for respect to that mode. With respect to that mode, the boundary is transparent. But this is a way, I like that you brought this absorbing, because in the literature, there is a lot of sponge type of boundary, absorbing boundaries, mirror boundaries. And I don't want to think that way, because this was the traditional way. What I want to say is that mathematically, this mode goes to the boundary, and just can only move to the right. So it really doesn't make sense for me to say, oh, I'm giving this guy a particular boundary condition. The only one that I can mathematically rigorously say I'm giving a boundary condition is to that one. So now if I want to interpret a mirror boundary condition, it's not that I'm telling this mode to come back. I'm telling this mode to source this mode with exactly the same, and that one is the one that keeps coming. It's kind of a little bit backwards way of doing things, but I think that's a mathematical natural way as opposed to kind of the more engineering way that people used to work or define in the 70s and 80s. So now let's just see what would have been if we actually want kind of a mirror boundary condition, a purely reflecting boundary condition. I would have had to say v plus is equal to the v minus. So now this turns into, if that's the case, this turns into that. And this one turns into zero. Right? Because I said v plus equal to v minus. And in that case, now our boundary condition would have been this one, compute the v minus, and that's what you feed to f comma t, and to g comma t you feed the zero. And of course this can be general. You can define all sort of boundary conditions this way. I noticed that I did one thing, that one sneaky thing, is that I did it with respect to the time derivative. That's just a matter of convenience. The same goes true if I take the time derivative off. So it's one is whether I modify the right-hand side, because the right-hand side is telling me about the time derivative, or whether I iterate and then redefine the value with this recipe. Either way, it's just perfectly fine. You see that the difference between these two options? I think it went too fast. What I said in here, so in the back of my mind, I'm bothered by the fact that I'm doing this derivative only slanted to the left. So I want to think that I want to modify this spatial derivative somehow. The boundary conditions, when I do it with respect to the time derivatives, are doing exactly that. They're modifying the right-hand side of the time derivatives. And by that, I'm modifying how I calculated the right-hand side, therefore the derivatives in the spatial domain. And once I modify that, then I take the step to iterate in time. The alternative would have been to just think in these terms. You iterate f comma g, you iterate f minus g. You know that f plus g is wrong because you haven't given the boundary condition yet. And then you pull out this. And then you say, well, but that one I set to zero, and then I use f is b minus divided by 2, and g is minus b minus divided by 2. So the only difference is where you impose a boundary condition on the time derivative of your variable or on your variable itself. Either way, it's just fine. So any questions on this? No? Yes? Much of silence? If you don't stop me, I'm going to keep going.
I'm not quite behind. Why do we know that? So I don't get the propagating thing of f minus g and f plus g, why it's that way wrong. So
how
do you illustrate that?
Yeah, so let's think of this again. And now imagine adding them up. So if I add the left-hand side, so I have g plus f, comma t. If I add the right-hand side, it's g plus f, comma x. So that's a combination. Now, if you want, call it any variable you want, right? So this tells me, just the equation itself, that the solution, the general solution to that equation is of the form, I'm gonna just call it h, of t plus x. Right? You can just plug this in here. If it happens that f plus g is of that, this is that f plus g is of that form, because f plus g satisfies this equation. And the other one, a minus, is the same. Now let's call it j, or this horrible, t minus x, f minus g. So then you know that t plus this, if any solution, any function of t plus x is moving to the left. Is that clear to you?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is moving from right to left, this moving from left to right. So then just because of the form of the equations, I know what moves one way or the other one. Which in turn means here you see the same variable with a one here that's positive, here I see the same variable with a minus one. So this tells me which direction they're moving.
So the positive parameter is on V and on V comma T, and it is
the here. They are the same, except that in one case, I need to impose a boundary condition prior to taking the step, because I'm imposing in the time derivative. The other one is I took the step, I now have the values of the variables, but I know that the variables have to be redefined because I haven't imposed the boundary conditions yet. So then I go and modify them.
So you expect, like, if it's simple, you expect both of them to grow.
They are both the same. They will be slightly different numerically related to the truncation error to the solution, but this is a stable way of doing the equations. There are, again, there's theorems that support doing it either way. I just find it more natural on the right-hand side. Then I take the time derivative, so I take the same time derivative the same. This might be just a convenience thing, because then I take my right-hand side, I compute a derivative. I take the right-hand side, I take the step, and then I have to do something new. For me, it's more natural is I take the derivative, define the right-hand side, fudge with them. To me, that's part of calculating what the right-hand side is, and then I take the step. But on Friday and during the exercise, you can try both ways. It's perfectly fine. So any questions? That?
So you have started from the beginning, instead of second derivative.
Yes.
With the first derivative, phi t phi x. You will have all the.
Oh, good. Yeah. That's right. And then I would, if I had done, so let's imagine we would have done this. So my problem could have been phi comma t equal, I'll see what it is. So it would have b plus comma t equal b plus comma x, of b minus comma t equal minus b minus comma x. And what is it? And this one would have been b plus b minus divided by 2.
Well, that's already the analysis of the boundary.
No, this is general. In this very simple problem, because let me just forget about that. Let me imagine that let's do this. Okay. Let's go back.
So which question are you addressing?
So you were asking if had I started with the other variables, I would have just that vector equation.
I just have d phi equal to dx phi.
Yeah. So then I would have had, so if I say, if I have that equation, b, which is the same, b comma t equal 1, b comma x.
Yes.
So that's the equation you're telling me.
Yeah, right, so that was the starting point.
So my starting point here was a second order equation.
If we started
with the first equation, so let's imagine that this was the only equation we're solving.
Yes.
Then this says, this is the equation like we were trying to playing with on Friday. This says, I need a boundary condition there, and it will be whatever it has to be. Even if I have a boundary condition here, I don't have the right to put even if I have a boundary here.
So this guy is moving which way?
Moving to your left.
Okay.
So I have to give some data here, but I'm not allowed to give it to give any data there. So for once, if I give some data there, then I'm over-specifying the problem. So that would be bad. And then if this mode wants to go that way, it really, this for this particular mode, doesn't know, cannot come back, because all perturbations are moving to the left. So in this problem, this is also why I want to discuss that one. Here is only a boundary condition here, this thing moves, and if you don't keep replenishing this, it will just go on, and then this thing will be a pulse that goes out and never comes back. So that would be the first thing for Friday. You were working with a periodic boundary condition, so this pulse just kept coming back. So just imagine you put a boundary there and let it go. And then you'll see this pulse, then zero comes back. Of course, in reality, you'll see some very small frequency noise that comes back that has to do with limitations of any discretization, but it will be much, much, much tiny. The reason, so this is a, I could have, with respect to these problems again, I could have chosen these variables, B plus and B minus, and rewritten this problem in this way. This would be just a sequence of advection equations. 1D equations moving to the left and to the right. The reason I didn't do this is because in practice, this could be very cumbersome. And the variables could be quite messy to even interpret. So sometimes it's just easier to introduce the simplest possible variables that give you this, the equation of motions that you're dealing with in the simpler terms, and only at the boundaries you take care of transforming to the variables at that back. So with that, I mean, you essentially, even though we have only discussed very simple systems, you essentially have all you need to iterate any PDE that is described by, that is described in a hyperbolic system. I swear. Just what could have made this thing more, a bit more complicated? Well, I could have had an equation. Let me just picture it again. Of this form, some, so we had a lambda there. Well, that lambda might depend on u, might depend on t, and might depend on x, comma x, plus some complicated undifferentiated function of u, or the variable u, the point at the time. But then what you would be doing to iterate this equation is given as a time step. Again, using the method of line, you would evaluate the right-hand side, all this, at each point. Once you have that, you would take the step to the, you take a step to the new level. That may involve several intermediate steps, say using the Runge-Kutta, but that's all you would do, with the exception of what you do at the boundaries, which, where you'll do what we just discussed. But that's it. Well, sorry, this lambda, I use lambda in two ways, the Courant number and then the eigenvalue the speeds, but hopefully clear distinction. But that's all. So now you can take any problem, put in a computer, and you shouldn't hope for the best. You should know at the end of the day where the solution you have is the correct one. So first, the issues that we discuss about stability will give you some strong footing to believe that your code, your implementation should be stable. By knowing the magnitude of the eigenvalues, you know how small the lambda should be. By knowing what particular discretization time step in algorithm, you know what the regime of stability of your iterator is, and so you'll take that lambda accordingly. By knowing what type of feature of the solution, so if you have a very smooth solution, or a very smooth initial data, at least locally in time for a while, you know that if you have a number of points, let's imagine like, that is reasonably well describing this function, you should be fine. If the solution, because this I have, let's say, my solution here looks like, with respect to this grid, this value. This one here. remember that silly test I told you, if you squint and you forget about the line, the continuous line, if you can picture the features of your solution, then you probably have enough resolution. If not, then you're way under resolved. So at least you should be able to start with this grid and evolve for a while. And then if the solution begins to show finer features, so for instance, if this one at some time later looks like that, then now you're violating the squinting test. Now you have, say, that point, so that is obviously severely under-resolved, so you're not going to have to increase your grid. But if you're in the so-called domain of the numerical convergence domain, so you have sufficiently good resolution that you can trust the solution you're getting, of course, the next question is this solution the solution to the problem you wanted to work to begin with? I mean, how do you test that your solution is correct? In some fields, people will tell you, oh, the solution looks right. I'm being taped here or whatever. So this is very common in astronomy. People say, oh, the solution is fine because it looks right. Well, if you know what the solution should look, why are you doing the problem to begin with? So typically, the interesting problems are the ones we don't know, and this is why we're trying to work so hard. But then that's when you need to ask all possible questions to try and gain some confidence of your solution. So let me just give you a list of things that you should do. So the first thing you want to look at, if you have a reason to believe that your problem will be stable, i.e. that it wouldn't blow up, just run for a very long time. Is it doing what you expect from that point of view, that it's not blowing up? But this can be further tested. So convergence is one. And then here I'm going to put in between quotes, and then I'm going to remove the quotes. Like convergence will mean, suppose you take the solution, you evolve it, now you take a norm of your solution and just plot it with respect to time for a sufficiently long time that the system has had time to deal with everything that could show. So remember, on Friday I was asking you, make sure that your pulse has at least a chance to go 5 times around your grid. Because if it just took a very small amount of time, then you might not see all the problems that may arise. So sufficiently long, remember, so this is sometimes referred to as crossing times. So if your grid is of a given size, make sure that you evolve for at least that amount of time, if not several times more. So now if you plot, this is very crude, so you plot the norm, so let's say the norm is doing something like that. Then increase your resolution. Just make sure you make your grid finer. And what you expect is that this finer resolved solution kind of tracks this one relatively well. But as time goes by, it may begin to peel off because errors accumulate. But then if you do it again at higher resolution, then the amount by which they coincide should be longer, because they're closer, and then we're going to try to make better sense of this one. So the first thing you want to know is that whether your solution is behaving relatively the same if your grid is finer and finer resolved. If you're doing a better job describing the solution, is your solution staying put for different number of resolutions? If your scheme is unstable, something that will happen, though it might take you a very long time to see this, is that if you do that exercise and you have the norm, let's say I ran with a grid of spacing h, and I might have something like that, and then you might see something that begins to blow up. Now I take this spacing h, then I take another one, let's say it's spacing h divided by 2, and I might see something that looks almost the same and then takes off. So that's a very bad sign, because you made your grid finer. Now you're doing a far better job or better job describing the features of your solution, and yet it blows up higher. This is usually spelling problems. It's saying that the problem you have may likely be ill-posed at the analytical level, or the discretization you have chosen may be unstable, i.e. your lambda might be too large. faced with that, of course, the easiest thing to do is just run it again with a smaller lambda. Take a lambda that is 5 times smaller and do it again. Do the same exercise. If this changes, so now this shows up there, then you're probably fine. Might have a problem that it would be difficult to iterate and get a sensible solution for a very long time, but at least that's a good sign. But of course, you can do far better than this. And this is what I'm going to take the quotes here. Let me just write again, convergence. So you work hard to achieve a code that in principle you think is, let's say, order delta t to some power. I'm going to put 3 here. Let's say you're using Ruge-Kutta third order. So you expect your code to converge, have errors that scales like delta t to the q power. And maybe you didn't space order delta x to the fourth power. You chose a higher derivative operator, higher accuracy in the derivative operator. You should be able to extract that. If you have a numerical solution, you should be able to check that your solution is convergent to this order, to at least the least of this one. So how do you do that? You write a convergence. So the underlying, remember what we said on Wednesday last week, the underlying understanding of the errors had to do with thinking that behind the approximations we have, there is a description in terms of a Taylor expansion. We can Taylor expand with respect to the true solution. So this actually means that the numerical solution evaluated at the discrete points, let's say at tn, and xj can be approximated, and there are rigorous results to support this, by some continuous function, let me call it g of t, evaluated at the same points, I'm just going to write t of x, times h, plus, now I'm going to write it m, of t and x times h to the q plus higher order. So that the numerical solution is expressible in terms of analytical solutions multiplied by appropriate values of the discretization to some power. Remember when we wrote, for instance, the derivative operator, the second derivative operator, we said d of u. It approximates the spatial derivative of u plus, and the error here is 1/2 for the second order, the second derivative of x, or the third derivative of x, of u times h squared. So here we're saying exactly that. The discrete function, the discrete result, is the analytical result, or the continuous result, plus another continuous result times h to some power. So this is exactly the same.
But what happens if you don't have a solution?
Exactly. Exactly. We're going there. Great point. So Paoli is saying, oh, what if we don't have this? And if we had this, we wouldn't be solving the problem. Again, this is another example. We don't know the analytic. So typically, it is very common for people to show, oh, my code converges well because on analytical solutions, I'm able to recover. So that's a good test to do, but it could be completely worthless, because usually, if you're dealing with a complicated problem, analytical solutions are very special. And they might not be triggering all the problems that a true solution might trigger. So, but now we want to at least extract some information. So the first one is, are we at least recovering the power, the dependence on the discretization that we expect? So going to Paola's questions, we can do is the following, run with h divided by 2, and run with h divided by 4. And for each one of these, we would have an expression like so, except that here we have h divided by 2, h divided by 2, and h divided by 4. So we can do the following. And by n, let me imagine I'm going to change this one. I'm going to put h. So as to say, well, this is a discrete solution with grid spacing h. So I can say, well, what happened if I compute the following? So if I do this, then formally I'm getting rid of the analytical solution, which I don't know. And what I have left is m Well, I'm taking the norm, so it's going to be some norm of m times h minus h the q. And of course, I can do the same thing with this one, with h divided by 2, sorry, and h divided by 4. And this will be m h divided by 2 to the q minus h divided by 4 to the q. Right? And once I have these two, I can take the ratio. So the ratio, I simplify the m's, and this is 2 to the q. So I can measure numerically what's the convergence rate of my solution. And if this guy has nothing to do with the ones we had at the very beginning, we should be questioning whether maybe a mistake is in there. Of course, the fact that it's convergent is a good sign, so what we may be seeing is that we're not sufficiently well resolved, that one of these may be too coarse, and we're contaminated with that, so we can just keep going h divided by 4, 8, 6, 16, et cetera, till we actually are convinced that that number there is 3, because eventually we're going to hit the worst case scenario. Is that clear?
So q is going to be the smallest between the two.
That's right. It should be. Sometimes, if you're very lucky, you have these things people call superconvergence, which just so happens. But suppose you were taking the derivative of a function. It just happened to have third derivative equal to 0 in the region that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So then you will see h to the fourth, perhaps. But that's not the generic behavior. So that would say you have a solution that converges. That converges with the order that you have written. So all those are extremely good checks to have. But what you still have not proven is that you're solving the problem you wanted to solve at the very beginning. So if you actually look at the code, well, if you remember the code I showed on Friday, I had a mistake. The mistake I had, and I corrected it on the spot, but let's imagine that. Remember, we had said this derivative in the second order approximation, we're saying is u I plus 1 minus u I minus 1 divided by 2h. Let's say I make a mistake and forget this too. So what I'm really solving, and then I do everything the same as, I mean, in exactly correct form. So what I would be effectively solving is not this problem, but instead that problem, right? Because that 2 would be factoring that one. So how would we find out? If we choose a small enough delta t, the solution will be stable. Nothing of everything that I said so far would pick up that I made a base mistake. So there is a last one, there are two other options that you have to try and test for this. And they are very related to each other. One is called independent residual evaluator. And I'm described mainly with words here. So what would you do in practice? You take your solution, so you evolve from here to there. Now you have the solution there. And you had an original equation that you wanted to solve for. Let me just, again, say this is for the equation. Well, I can turn it into this equation, defined this way, L of u. Right. So that operator L, acting on the solution that I think I got here, should give me a 0. Of course, it will never give me a 0. It will give me a 0 up to a truncation error. The task of the rule of the game is better explained with a simple exercise. Suppose I had a polynomial, and I say, I swear to God that x equal b divided by a is a solution to the root of this polynomial. And you don't trust me because you know I'm sloppy. And then the first thing you'll say, well, give me the x. I'll plug it in here. And if it's not 0, then you'll say, this is not a solution. So you're doing exactly the same thing here. You're saying, give me the solution. I'll plug it into an approximation to the problem you tell me you're solving. And then I'll try to see if it is sufficiently close to 0. And because you can generate a different solutions for different spacing, give me all those, and I see if this thing is in reality going to zero. So the rule of the game is to make sure that you don't try, you don't do exactly the same step that you did before that would have crept up a particular error. So you don't want to repeat the error.
But if you avoid the UT,
exactly. The point is that you don't. So I have to do everything independent, and this is why I put it here. Absolutely, you're right. So for instance, I would say, well, I need to evaluate U, T. I have these two levels, right? So let me just blow up these two levels. So no one, because now I'm not going to be evolving. So I could even use a recipe that had I worked to evolve with this, I would have something completely unstable. So U, T, no one tells me I can do this. I have to do this. So I could use, say, the average of these 2 points minus the average of those 2 points. That's only first order accurate. But what are the chances I'll make the same mistake in coding this that I said the other one? The derivative operator, so I need to evaluate derivative. So rather than using these 2 points, I can use something that is slanting. So I can use this one here to evaluate that point there. And say this one, to evaluate there, then take the average. So the idea is that every single step that you did before, you try not to reproduce. And if you happen to have used Mathematica to compute the very complicated system of equations that produce the right-hand side, forget about that script, write a new script, do it again, and then get a completely independent residual operator. So that's a very good test. And if you satisfy that, then you can shut everyone up. I've done everything. The other one is to say, well, take your original equation, whatever those things are, and just make up a solution. You don't have a solution, just make one up. You say, oh, I'm going to take U is, e to the t times x. Because that's not a solution to this problem, right? But if I plug this function into this problem, it's going to give me a residual. It's going to give something that is non-zero. Well, use that non-zeroness and add it to the right-hand side. So I can add here plus something else. So that when I plug this in here, it happens to be a solution. Right? So I add something so that this is a solution. And then I can evolve with that. I modify the right-hand side. I add a source so that it produces this solution for me. I can evolve and see if I recover that one. So that's the closest to having an analytical solution. The shortcoming of this one is that you have to make sure that you pick something that's so general that you don't happen to have some magical cancellations or things where you could have made a mistake that are now multiplied by a zero. Right, so that's another one. So just invade a solution by modifying the equations. So you have the equations you are solving plus some sources, and then see if you achieve that solution. So with that, then you could be sure stability tells you a heck of a lot. Now you have something where you can begin to hope that these solutions are correct. Convergence tells you that you did your homework, that every single piece in there at least will behave in the right way when you take the discretization length to zero. And the independent residual evaluators, and to some degree this one as well, is telling you that the problem you're solving is indeed the problem you wanted to solve at the very beginning. Beyond that, so with those tools you can do, as I said, any PDE problem that you can afford to do. And by you can afford to do means, well, is the problem sufficiently tractable with your computational resources to be able to attempt that problem? And if the answer is no, then maybe what you need is a larger computer, parallelize your code, I mean, a whole bunch of things that are beyond the scope of what we would discuss here. But there are things, there's a vast amount of knowledge on that. But at the core of every single complicated code out there is the strategies that we describe here. So if you understand this, you have more than enough to take the first steps, and then careful because you may run too much into this direction. Any questions? So on Friday, that's what we want to do. So just take your problem. So first, take the problem you did with the advection. Hopefully, you have it under control. If you're not, then just finish that up. Then put a boundary. Once you have the boundary, then upgrade it to the second order wave equation. You've seen that the only thing you're going to do is just add two more variables, and then something funny at the boundary. So first, you can start again with the second order wave equation and make periodic boundary conditions so you have the pulse just going around and then put the boundary conditions in. And if you have that, then you have all the building blocks that we care.
Okay.